Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
President Obama says the Republicans drove the economy into a ditch, but now they want the car keys back.
And for the last 20 months, we put on our boots and we got into the mud and we've been shoving that car out of the ditch inch by inch, and they've been standing on the side the whole time watching, telling us, no, you're not pushing hard enough. You're not doing it the right way. Not lifting a finger to help.
It's only a partial strategy. Voters won't let Democrats keep the keys if they think the Republicans got the car stuck, but the Dems dug it deeper into the ditch. So let's see how far either party can ride this tow truck to victory. And listeners, we have an open thread for this on our politics website. It's freecountry.org. This is issue 11 in our 30 issues in 30 days election series. Let everybody else obsess only on the horse race. We are doing an issue in depth every day until the election. Today, issue 11, true or false, the Republicans drove the economy into a ditch. So go start the online conversation at itsafreecountry.org. How true, how false, and how much does that argument matter when deciding who to give the economy's car keys to for the next 2 years? Go to our Into a Ditch open thread at itsafreecountry.org. On the air, we'll get two views on this now. First, from Democratic Congressman Jim Himes of Fairfield County, Connecticut. We heard from his opponent, Dan DiBasella, on another recent 30-issue show. Before going to Congress last year, Himes had been a Goldman Sachs vice president and a green housing nonprofit group executive. Congressman Himes, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you. Are you using that line, too, that the Republicans drove the economy into a ditch?
Well, you look at what happened during the Bush administration and the substantial increase in our debt, the continued, and I use the word continued deliberately there, loosening of regulations on the financial services sector, the belief that you could cut taxes, fight two wars, add a benefit to health to Medicare, and create a stable economy, is just wrong. And I use the language I did on the regulation for a reason, which is, yes, look, the Republicans right now have no answer on the economy that is any different from what they've been saying for 30 years. But we also need to be honest here and say that starting with the Clinton administration and perhaps before, there was an emphasis on some of the things that got us into this mess, which is, letting the big banks do whatever they want, a light touch on the oil industry and exploration, and anybody who's watched television in the last 2 years knows how that plays out.
So would it be the more proper argument to say that both parties drove the economy into a ditch by letting your former industry have its way with both Democratic and Republican administrations, repealing Glass-Steagall, ramping up the subprime mortgage ratios at Fannie and Freddie? You mentioned the oil industry, and I could go on.
Well, it is absolutely fair to say that both parties bear some blame for being seduced by the notion that Wall Street and banks could effectively regulate themselves. 700 years of financial history disproves that, and people on both sides got too comfortable with that notion. In a bipartisan way, we have over-subsidized, over-emphasized home ownership in this country in a way that when we moved the rate into the high 60s, created some people that we called homeowners, but they were actually nothing of the sort. The difference, Brian, is that for the Republicans, deregulation is a religion. All regulations are bad. All regulations stand in the way of economic growth, which is just plain wrong. This is the song that they sang in the 1930s when they said that the SEC and all of the other regulatory institutions put into place to prevent another Great Depression would crush the economy. It was the end of capitalism. In fact, the exact opposite happened, right? From about 1935 to the early 1980s, this country saw a historically unprecedented period of economic growth that was there because smart, well-thought-out regulation creates a level playing field and really turbocharges growth.
The Republicans will say that except for the housing collapse, which most economists and politicians from both camps failed to foresee, they had lots of job growth during the Bush years and brought the economy roaring back from the ditches that Bush had to deal with. at or before the beginning of his term, the collapse of the tech bubble, fallout from the Enron and WorldCom and other accounting scandals, and, of course, the economic repercussions of 9/11, which happened in Bush's first year. Not fair?
So if I understand this correctly, Brian, the argument is that except for the most severe economic crash that this country has seen since the Great Depression, it was a pretty good period of time. That's the ultimate. And other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? Look, there was, you know.
Well, I guess they part of that argument is that was a complete failure of almost everybody from, you know, all corners of the liberal and conservative establishment to foresee that extent of a housing bubble and crash.
Yeah, but so the argument, Brian, is how do we want to proceed? Do we want to proceed with a party that makes a religion of deregulation that would have the oil companies, and you're seeing it right now as they pound the table for a lifting of the moratorium on deep water drilling, you know, as they almost single-mindedly reject the controls of the Dodd-Frank bill? Do we want to move forward with a party who makes a religion of eliminating all regulations, and by the way, continuing to try to foist on us this fantasy, because deficits do matter, Brian, but they continue to try to foist on us this fantasy that you can cut taxes and decrease the deficit. I mean, we saw this during George W. Bush. We saw this during Ronald Reagan. When they cut taxes, look, we all like tax cuts, and I'd love to run on the premise that we could cut everybody's taxes for everything always, but you can't do that and credibly say that you care about fiscally responsibility. The historical record is just not supportive of that.
So one of the biggest arguments the Republicans are making now is that keeping the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy will help get the economy out of the ditch, that a time of high and stubborn unemployment is no time to raise taxes on those with the ability to create jobs and hire workers. Do you reject that?
Well, Brian, as you probably know, I have taken a fair amount of guff from my own party because I have come out in favor of a temporary extension of the upper-end tax cuts. And I do that not because I'm unaware of the fiscal consequences of that, unlike the Republicans, who in their documents say that they're fiscally responsible, but they're going to blow a $3.8 trillion hole in the budget. But I do it, and not because the fairness argument isn't a powerful argument, but because you do put downward pressure on economic growth when you raise anybody's taxes. And I'm not talking about rich people versus poor people here. The reality is that there's a lot of small businesses and regional businesses, and yes, there's some big businesses, because that's a big point with the press, that rely on the cash flow that comes from their businesses for investment. And so I have come out in favor of a temporary extension of those upper-end tax cuts. And to give you one example, you know, Moody's and Mark Zandi have said that were those cuts to expire, you could see as much as a 770,000 job decrease associated with the expiration. It just seems to me that right now, when we're looking at the possibility of a double dip, when the recovery is tentative, now is not the time to be raising those taxes.
And so beyond that, as Americans in your district and all over the country are deciding whether to give Republicans control of Congress, the Democrats have a lot of people skeptical on the grounds that the stimulus added $1 trillion to the deficit, with the best you can say is that things aren't even worse than they are. Adding the health care burden, which almost no one believes will really be deficit neutral, and wanting cap and trade, which would be a big energy tax, which is a tax on almost everything, just as the economy is trying to gain subtraction, the critics say. So that combination is seen as digging a deeper ditch by putting ideological priorities over practical ones. And I realize there's a lot in that question, but that's the package that I think the Democrats are fighting right now.
Well, that's right. And what you said is a very political thing, you know, and, you know, I've been very honest and very open with my constituents on the hard choices that we face. You know, the question is, what is the alternative on health care reform? And my opponent and the Republicans are calling for its repeal. After we have begun the process of closing the donut hole for seniors, after we put in place any number of pilots, which over time will help us cut the costs of the healthcare system, after we made the insurance industry a lot more accountable, they're saying just do away with that. Let's go back to where we were, where we were is a moment of, you know, of just catastrophe, where people were losing their jobs and losing their health insurance. I'm not certifying that the health care reform was perfect. We've got work to do. But do you really want to go back to a much less perfect system? Energy is a classic example, right? Mm-hmm. You know, do we really want to continue to see next generation energy companies, which are going to make companies like Microsoft and Google look small? Do we really want them being founded and growing up in Shanghai and in Europe the way they are right now? Or do we want to work hard and maybe be honest with the American people about the fact that we need to get away from coal and oil over time? Carefully. We don't want to devastate West Virginia, but that's the conversation that the Democrats are offering. The Republicans are offering this notion that what the Democrats are doing is bad, which has a certain amount of appeal when you've got so many people unemployed. But they offer no affirmative vision, no path to how do we lead the energy revolution the way we led the IT revolution? How do we, you know, make the healthcare system? They say it's all about tort reform. Fine, that's a part of it. But my God, you guys owned Congress for 6 years with a Republican president. You didn't move an inch. So I think that when the choice is clear, you know, Americans will figure out that they're being offered a, you know, an affirmative, constructive, if not perfect vision versus just let's go back to the past.
Democratic Congressman Jim Himes, my guest for another few minutes from southwestern Connecticut as he runs for re-election in the context of our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. Today, issue 11, true or false, the Republicans drove the economy into a ditch, something President Obama keeps saying. Coming up will be part two, where we'll talk to Charles Gasparino, who wrote a book called Bought and Paid For, The Unholy Alliance Between Barack Obama and Wall Street. Some of the comments on this coming on to our itsafreecountry.org politics website. Bob from New Rochelle writes, the ditch analogy is too mild because it implies we only need a tow truck to recover. A better description would be that George W. Bush, for all the reasons being discussed, drove the economy off a seaside rock cliff where it crashed and burned before the wreckage was swept into the sea. We are so deeply in this that we have no way out and will become a third world country within the next 20 years, writes Bob from New Rochelle. David in Brooklyn, they didn't drive the car into a ditch. They built the road that led right into the ditch. The road just happened to go right through the Golden City, where profits can be plucked off trees and $100 bills blow along streets in the wind. So add your thoughts to those colorful ones at itsafreecountry.org. Antonia in Emerson, New Jersey, is going in a different direction, though, I think. Hi, Antonia.
Hello. Thank you, Brian. I believe both parties, in their own way, are equally responsible, and they use it to play off on each other. Let me point out to you that the recent financial meltdown, derivatives played an essential role in it, and they were proved to be unregulated by the Clinton administration and Mr. Sumner, who just recently left this administration. How many times do I look at agricultural subsidies and recognize that Cargill and people like ADM continue to suck up $30 billion a year, and nobody does anything about it? Agricultural subsidies were designed to provide price supports for family farms, an institution that no longer exists for most people in the United States.
And, Antonio, I'm going to leave it there. You've made your point. Congressman Himes, do you want to respond to that?
Well, Brian, you heard me say right up front that there's a little bit of a disconnect in trying to blame everything on the Republican Party, particularly with respect to the deregulation of the financial services industry, because she's fundamentally right. Look, the law that was passed that deliberately made the derivatives market unregulated was supported by the Clinton administration. So, look, if we're having a political food fight, it's fun to say that it's all their fault. But, of course, the real situation is a little bit more complicated than that. The difference, of course, is that we Democrats are willing to say, hey, let's get the regulation right. Let's do what we did in the 30s, which led to, you know, 60 years of vigorous growth. Let's not overdo it. Whereas the other side is just saying, no, none, not at all. It just, you know, we're not willing to contemplate any thoughtful regulation.
Another one from our website, TKNY77 writes, Albany gets the pile of crap award for being the nation's most failed government, but Obama rehired most of Bush's economic team. So it's a tie. They both failed. Any thought on the Obama economic team? Oh, you know, a lot of Democrats are unhappy that Geithner was retained, that Bernanke was retained.
Yeah, Brian, I think, you know, it's sort of hard to really be thoughtful about this person did this wrong. I think you know, with the passage of time and as the recovery continues, we're going to look at a fairly sharp about face that happened when the Obama administration took office. Here's a couple of facts, because facts, you know, you can talk about personalities, but facts matter. You know, January of 2009, when Obama took office, and the next month, there were 750,000 jobs lost each of those months. Now we've seen 8 months of consistent but slow private sector job growth. We lost $17 trillion in household wealth at the bottom of this crash, and we've recovered about $8 trillion of that household wealth. Corporate profits, God bless them, are up. The stock market is up substantially. So those are all facts that suggest that, you know, they did something right, if not perfectly. They're just hard facts for most Americans to absorb and take much comfort from because, of course, job creation has lagged what we would all really like to see. You know, 15 million people out of work is just something that causes you to say, even if we've turned the corner, you know, we've got a lot of work yet to do.
What would be your biggest job creation policy points if the Dems are reelected?
Well, you know, there's a short-term and a long-term answer to that question. Short-term, this country has embarrassing infrastructure. You land at Kennedy Airport, you get on a train, you compare that to what they're doing in Asia, setting themselves up to compete globally in a huge way, China investing massively in its own infrastructure. You know what? When we invest in our trains and our airports and our, you know, freight hauling capability, not only are we putting Americans to work to do that, but by the way, you're really helping the god-awful traffic in my district, but you're really setting us up to succeed. Energy, you know, again, the CEO of Google says that the energy revolution is going to make the IT revolution as a job creator and as a wealth creator pale. And why aren't we taking the steps we need to lead there? Longer term, Brian, you know, we now live in a globally competitive world, and we don't talk about this enough, but if we really want to continue to be prosperous in the years to come, we are going to continue to do what this administration, what Arne Duncan in particular has done, which is to say we must improve our schools. Every American kid, whether that kid grows up in the inner city or in an affluent suburb, must be prepared to compete with some pretty darn smart innovators in places like Singapore and China.
So before you go, on the energy issue, since you keep raising it, people like Bjorn Lomborg, who, you know, used to be with Greenpeace and now he's considered by some a conservative on energy and the environment, he says, look, global warming is real. People have to do something about it. But cap and trade would just tax the economy and drag it down while we're trying to look for that next generation solution. Better just to have positive incentives for people who come up with those new technologies, but dispense with the idea of taxing carbon. Where are you on that?
Well, that, of course, has been the strategy all along with tax credits and tax breaks for people who, you know, install Energy Star appliances in their home. That's great stuff, and we should continue to do it, right? But we haven't talked much about the fiscal issue here. The more tax breaks we give, the more subsidy we give, the tougher it is on our fiscal situation. The challenge here, Brian, is, and the guy is right to be very, very focused on the timing and how this plays out. But the challenge, and this is just, you know, basic market economics, is how over time, in a way that doesn't hurt our exporters, that doesn't devastate the state of West Virginia, which is coal-based, that doesn't devastate the southeast of the United States, which, you know, burns a lot of coal to make electricity, do we make other forms of energy price competitive with carbon-based energy? You know, when we got rid of the fax machine, or, you know, we didn't all of a sudden make faxes a lot more expensive. We just developed new technology, which was cheaper, email, PDF files. So we know how to do this. And the question is, over what period of time are we going to commit ourselves to making new, clean, American sources of energy price competitive? You can talk about cap and trade. The House passed a bill that had, you know, all kinds of protections for exporters, and, you know, the environmentalists who liked cap and trade went crazy over it, said it was way too weak. But if we're really going to move the needle here, over time, in a careful way, we're going to make next-generation energy sources more competitive with oil and coal. You just can't beat those market forces.
Congressman Jim Himes, Democrat from Connecticut, running for re-election. We talked to his Republican opponent last week, Dan DiBasella. Thank you so much for coming on and talking Republican and Democrat economics with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and Charles Gasparino next. As promised, stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and don't forget to check out our daily Brian Lehrer News Quiz question and see if you've been paying attention. We have a new question every day at our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Today's question is about how Stuyvesant Town wound up in foreclosure at itsafreecountry.org. Now, we've been playing short bites of President Obama making this into-the-ditch argument about the economy. So here's a full-throated minute-and-a-half version, and then we'll talk to Charles Gasparino, who somehow manages to write for the Fox Business Channel and the Huffington Post. His new book is called Bought and Paid For, The Unholy Alliance Between Barack Obama and Wall Street. But here's the president on August 4th at an AFL-CIO convention.
You've got these folks who drove America's economy into a ditch. And for the last 20 months, we put on our boots and we got into the mud and we've been shoving that car out of the ditch inch by inch, and they've been standing on the side the whole time watching, telling us, no, you're not pushing hard enough. You're not doing it the right way. Not lifting a finger to help. And now we finally got that car up on the blacktop there, about to drive, and they say they want the keys back. Well, you can't have the keys because you don't know how to drive. You don't know how to drive. You're not going to get the keys back. You're not going to get them back. Somebody pointed out to me that when you're in a car and you want to go forward, you put it in D. You want to go back in the ditch, you put it on R. So I just want everybody to think about that.
Well, he had that audience in the palm of his hand at an AFL-CIO convention in August, President Obama, arguing why he says the voters should not return control of the economy to the Republicans. My next guest has been known to dish to both sides, but especially to excess and corruption on Wall Street. Charles Gasparino is that rare bird who works for the Fox Business Network but contributes to the Huffington Post. His PR material notes that he was born in the Bronx to a construction worker and a housewife. And his latest book is Bought and Paid For, The Unholy Alliance Between Barack Obama and Wall Street. Charles, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your previous book, The Sellout, which was a bestseller and a Wall Street Journal and USA Best Business Book of 2009, traced the roots of the financial crisis back to the 1970s, when you say Wall Street first veered off the road by embracing a new business model. Before we get your take on the partisan question of today, remind us of some of that background. What changed on Wall Street in the 1970s?
Well, a lot of little things. You know, the traditional business of, you know, usually go to a Wall Street firm if you're an individual to get advice to buy a bond or a stock. If you're a corporation, you go there to figure out whether you should sell stock or merge. That business became not obsolete, but the margins shrank considerably. And so Wall Street was looking for a new profit, a new way to make money. And the notion of risk and trading was sitting right there as a fastball down the middle. Now, why was that? Inflation was conquered. Computer technology was created in a way that you can create these sort of complex securities. And then you had the government. And you had the government sort of telling Wall Street, help us expand home ownership to the masses. And how did Wall Street do that? Well, it created a mechanism where banks, instead of keeping loans on their books, mortgages, could take those loans and sell it to a third party, a Wall Street firm, which would then package those loans and trade it in a mortgage-backed security. And that was the beginning of this new business model, which, by the way, Brian, blew up about five or six times, as I show in The Sellout, with government coming in and aiding and sort of abetting the sort of to try to smooth things out.
So that was really mostly the 90s, though, right? I mean, if you go back to the 70s, there was high inflation.
You're talking about the late 70s, by the way. That's when this began. It was the 80s, too. 86, you had an issue where Wall Street blew up, big losses. Merrill Lynch almost went under back then.
Was it a political issue back then? Did Democrats and Republicans argue with each other over whether Wall Street should be allowed to go in those directions?
It was embraced by both sides, and that's the fascinating thing. I mean, you know, if you look at housing policy, policy, particularly since the 1990s, when Henry Cisneros and became Bill Clinton's HUD secretary, the notion of expanding home ownership to the masses through prodding Fannie and Freddie to do these sort of subprime loans and things of that nature began with Cisneros, continued through Andrew Cuomo in
a
major way.
We've done a whole separate segment on in this series.
Right. And was enhanced by George Bush's HUD secretary. So it's a bipartisan sin, I guess you could say.
The direction continued in the 80s and 90s and 2000s with our government-insured bank deposits being not just, you know, it's not just the subprime loans, but our government-insured bank deposits became increasingly intertwined with risky investments that these companies were taking as Wall Street firms.
Well,
yes?
think of what happened in 1998. They got rid of a law called Glass-Steagall. 1999, got to get my date straight here. That law separated out a commercial bank from an investment bank. You couldn't put them together. But then came Citigroup, did a deal anyway, basically merging an investment bank and a commercial bank, where you merge Grandma Millie's checking account with risk-taking, you know, bond traders. And they got Glass-Steagall overturned to make Citigroup legal. By the way, Glass-Steagall was overturned, gotten rid of through a coalition of, I guess you could say, progressives that worked on Wall Street, like Bob Rubin, and free market types that worked on that worked in the House and the Senate, like Phil Graham. And by the way, what's interesting, it's neither progressive, it turned out, or free market, because what you did was you subsidized the risk. Citigroup was never going to go under with $800 billion in deposits, even if it's risk take, no matter how much its risk traders took.
And 1999 was a Democratic president,
absolutely,
Clinton, but a Republican Congress. They
absolutely
controlled both houses at that time.
Absolutely.
Do you know? Did one push the other into it? Was this something that, you know, because there were a number of things at that time after Clinton lost Congress in 94,
right,
where he was like, well, I don't really want to do this, but they got the majority. And in order for me to look moderate enough to get the rest of my agenda done, I'm going to have to go along, like some aspects of welfare reform. Was that one of those?
You have to realize, and what I tried to show in Bought and Paid For, is that there's historically this link, this crony capitalist link between Wall Street and government. It's bipartisan. I focus on the first 2 years of the Obama administration only because of the irony of him calling them fat cats every time he has a chance. And also because it's a very current issue, and you wouldn't think of Barack Obama as being part of that sort of group, being in that clique. But I think Bill Clinton surrounded himself with Bob Rubin. Bob Rubin, the head of, became a major player at Citigroup, by the way, right after Glass-Steagall was gotten rid of and Citigroup is declared legal. He was, you know, chairman of Goldman Sachs. And there are many, many others within his economic circle who are very close to Wall Street, Larry Summers being one.
What do you think about the Obama argument then? And you heard that extended clip on your way in, that Republicans drove the economy into a ditch in the last 8 years. They would point to deregulation being more aggressive than ever, the trillion-dollar wars, the huge deficits from the tax cuts on the wealthy.
I don't agree with it because particularly the notion of tax cuts. I mean, if you look at what happened with Wall Street risk-taking, I mean, tax cuts don't even begin to explain why all these banks went out there and started rolling the dice. I take the view that it was Glass-Steagall was, you know, they got rid of Glass-Steagall. It wasn't a Republican thing. It was clearly signed into law by President Clinton. Graham Leach Bliley basically did away with that, and it was supported by his entire economic team, from Larry Summers to Bob Rubin to Arthur Levitt, the head of the SEC. And deregulation began with him. It's very interesting,
and it's interesting too, coming back to the present, that the new group of Republicans, the Tea Partiers, are angry at the Republicans for driving the economy into a ditch too. The Republican establishment, you know, as they see it.
Right.
But if the Democrats from the left cite war, deregulation, and giveaways to the rich, the Tea Party cites Republican big spending, like on Medicare prescription drugs, no child left behind, not cutting entitlements enough. So at least in terms of the federal government's deficit, did these arguments from left and right add up to massive Republican economic failure in, you know, the Gingrich and Bush years, if you will, say 1995 to 2005?
I don't think so. I mean, listen, the Tea Partiers make – I mean, there are certain issues where the far right and the far left agree. I think you can find common ground in immigration. Both don't want immigration to a certain extent. The notion of spending –
Both wait, the far – what you're calling the far left doesn't want immigration?
Sometimes, I mean, I've heard people in the far left say it takes jobs away from African Americans, minorities that are already here. I've heard that argument in the past. I've also heard environmentalists say immigration is bad for the environment. So there are certain common areas where the far right and the far left agree. The notion of sort of crony capitalism is one of those areas. I will tell you this, however, and when I say crony capitalism, that Wall Street, these sort of big corporations have an in with government. And I've heard people on the far left critique Bill Clinton as being part of that clique as well. I will tell you this, I point this out in Bought and Paid For, you know, when the Wall Street guy sat down and started to sort of weigh who they should put their money behind, one of the reasons why they put it behind so heavily Obama is that they felt much more comfortable with him in one-on-one meetings. They did not feel like, you know, that John McCain was someone that was going to listen to their arguments or be on their side. They clearly did not feel comfortable with the Tea Party types. They felt more comfortable with what they perceived as Obama being someone who understood the notion that he needs a partnership with Wall Street.
And that's certainly one of the interesting things in your book, and my guest is Charles Gasparino, author now of Bought and Paid For, The Unholy Alliance Between Barack Obama and Wall Street. And at the beginning, you trace Wall Street's courting of Barack Obama for president and the disaffection that they had felt toward John McCain. I guess that was a remarkable part of the book to me, because you would think that the people on Wall Street, to the extent that they were just looking out for the interests of their companies, would think that John McCain, as a lifelong free marketeer — yes, he was for some things like, you know, McCain-Feingold right. campaign finance reform, but he was basically a free market guy. He was a self-described maverick, so maybe they felt they couldn't trust him or couldn't control him that much if he was elected president, but that they would trust him less than Barack Obama, who did come out of inner city Chicago community organizing and sure. all of that. How did that happen?
It was remarkable. You also have to take a step back. Look who runs the big Wall Street firms right now. Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, clearly a progressive. Talked to him about various issues, and he will agree, I would say 95% of the time, on all the sort of domestic issues that the president agrees on, and his economic policies, taxes, you name it, healthcare.
Except maybe on bank reform.
Maybe he doesn't like some aspects of bank reform, although he got a lot of what he wanted in the end. You know, they don't feel that this is that bad right now.
And your book, again, says you basically take the position that that doesn't have so much teeth, or at least it has many, many loopholes that they can find their ways to walk through.
And many less teeth. And I will say this. One of the things that was interesting, and in the book I point this out, is that a lot of the agenda for financial reform was being driven by people like Blanche Lincoln, who was, you know, the centrist
senator, Democrat from Arkansas.
Yeah, but who's playing the populist card. The White House did not feel comfortable with a lot of stuff that she was doing. The Volcker.
Because she had a Democratic primary challenge from
right.
the left.
Absolutely. And she played up this whole notion of beating up on Wall Street. There was an aspect of financial reform that ultimately got watered down that Wall Street lobbied against. It actually did get it watered down, but that wouldn't have even been an issue if it wasn't for the fact that the activists both on the left and on the right were prodding financial reform well to the left of what this administration wanted. When I say this administration, Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, Rahm Emanuel, who all have connections with Wall Street, as I show in the book.
So how did we get to that point where, as you write about, as you just said, that so many of the captains of industry on Wall Street
right.
were Democrats rather than Republicans?
You know, what I tried to be extremely fair in this book to point out that there's a historical basis for this that goes beyond the Obama administration. I go back many years, talk about the Bush administration, talk about this sort of crony capitalism being a bipartisan sin. What I found interesting about Obama is that for all his community organizing and all this sort of left wing, I guess, background, he did embrace the same notion that Wall Street is part of the administration almost as an adjunct of the administration.
Do they regret it now, the Wall Streeters?
To some extent, they do. It's interesting. Right now, as you know, they're hedging their bets. They're throwing money at Republicans as they always do in midterm elections because they love divided government to a certain extent. But I will say this, Brian, I don't believe that Jamie Dimon is going to put the full weight of J.P. Morgan Chase, the most powerful bank right now, you know, to support a Republican candidate. I just don't see it. I mean, he agrees with Obama personally on too many issues. I don't believe Brian Moynihan, who's the head of B of A, Bank of America, same thing, of progressive, is going to do that. I don't believe that Goldman Sachs is going to go head over heels for a Republican who's, by the way, a Republican who's going to be prodded and pushed by the Tea Partiers who hate Wall Street.
But don't you write in the book about how J.B. Dimon's so frustrated with Obama after all the anti-Wall Street rhetoric, after the financial reform, after Elizabeth Warren started, you know, kind of flirting with John Boehner and shifting campaign donations more to the Republicans than they had been?
Absolutely. You know, no one likes to be called names. And I think one of the problems Wall Street had with being called names, I mean, listen, what are they in the business of? They're in the business of dealing with the public, having the public entrust their money. And I think that was incredibly bad PR for them. They didn't like it. But in the end, they think net-net, you know, how bad has this president been for us? And I'll tell you, it's going to be a bad quarter for Wall Street, but Goldman Sachs is still going to make $7 billion. How many corporations are making $7 billion in this economy?
I guess it's too hard to be frustrated with the status quo if you're working at Goldman Sachs.
That's right.
All right. Charles Gasparino, his new book, Bought and Paid For, The Unholy Alliance Between Barack Obama and Wall Street. Thank you very much.
Anytime. Thanks, Brian.
And again, listeners, you can keep this conversation going on our politics webpage. It's freecountry.org. And coming up next, we have Dana Stevens and Daniel O'Krent on HBO's Boardwalk Empire. Is this the new Sopranos for the Great Recession era? Is Steve Buscemi up to a leading role? Stay with us.